Telecast.
Hi, I'm Justin Crosby, and welcome to another Telecast. For more videos on AI and next-generation technology in the TV and content production industry, with the movers and shakers, just hit subscribe in the button below. Everyone's talking about generative AI in the content industry, and we've recently dedicated a few shows to the latest tools available, and also the ethics involved in this technology that's transforming the TV industry at a lightning speed. And we've spoken to early adopter producers who are leading the way. Well, this week, I'm delighted to have a veteran of new content technology on the show to share a perspective from a different angle. Welcome to Telecast, digital media and AI consultant, Dan Taylor-Watt. Hi, Dan. How are you doing?
Thanks for having me. I'm not sure how I feel about being a veteran.
Veteran? Well, you are. You know, I think if you've been working in anything to do with AI for longer than 3-4 years, that constitutes a veteran, doesn't
it? I'll take it then.
So you spent many years involved in the development and the deployment of iPlayer and BBC Sounds at the BBC. Let's start there. Give us a sense of how you've been working with the content industry and technology to create, you know, iPlayer was really a benchmark when it rolled out a number of years ago. But so tell us about your career journey, first of all, in developing the iPlayer and BBC Sounds.
Sure. So it started way back in 2001 when I joined the BBC, and my very first project was developing what was BBC Radio Player. So the first ever streaming service for the BBC, which was very sellotape and string affair. And then after a while, then I moved over onto the television side of things and picked up the reins on iPlayer. And that was I often sort of describe the history of iPlayer in three chapters. So there's sort of 6 years of riding broadband growth, and then 6 years of device proliferation of new tablets and connected TVs. And then when I took over, when it got really hard and Netflix arrived and the kind of, and I think transforming it from that, you know, 7-day catch up service, which people loved, but kind of then started to kind of pale by comparison with those really rich SVOD services. So that was the sort of challenge, was to kind of take the product from that kind of quite static sort of catch up catalog into something that felt a bit richer.
Yeah. And think about the timeline, actually. So did iPlayer launch around the same? It must have launched before Netflix or.
It was ahead of the Netflix really ramping up into streaming. So obviously Netflix had been around in the sort of DVD, and Reed Hastings has very generously sort of credited iPlayer with kind of paving a bit of the way back in the day.
Right.
So yeah, it was very kind of early doors when it did launch. But it's interesting, sort of over time, it felt like a lot of those things that we were having to kind of build from the ground up did become more standardized and off the shelf over that time.
It's interesting when you talk about broadband adoption and speed, because we completely take that for granted now. But actually, you're right, everybody remembers that sound of your dial-up modem and then, you know, the CD-ROMs on the front of magazines, which are, you know, tons of landfill, I'm sure, around the UK. But now we take that for granted. And I mean, in terms of iPlayer, what were the main technological barriers that you overcame to take that from, as you say, a simple catch-up service to something similar to what you see today?
Yeah. I mean, I think that I think one was kind of getting close to the expectations of broadcast, which an incredibly mature technology had been developed for decades, where you just expect it to work. And there's a lot to kind of overcome in terms of that being the experience of streaming. Took quite a bit of work to develop that. I think the sort of expectation of the experience being personalized, like it was interesting, there was a sort of generation who were kind of growing up with Netflix and YouTube where there was just the expectation. And if they came across iPlayer at that time, they're like, oh, it's weird that they think that will be relevant to me. Not, it didn't occur to them that maybe we were showing everyone the same thing. So that business of kind of starting to personalize it and to begin to sort of A/B test what different things work for different people, that was a huge amount of effort to get to a place where a lot of the big technology companies had been investing huge amounts for a long period by then.
Yeah. And looking at how you look at iPlayer and the functionality now, and you know, the latest iteration of Netflix, for example. How do you see them side by side now in terms of how developed? I mean, which is the superior technological product?
Yeah. I mean, I think that I'm really proud of where iPlayer is, and I think that it massively punches above its weight in terms of the level of investment. So I think the gaps really closed a lot. I think a lot of what Netflix is doing around the kind of level of optimization, so for any given program they'll have dozens if not hundreds of different thumbnails that they're dynamically A/B testing, is iPlayer's not doing it at that scale yet. So I think there is still a gap in terms of the level of investment, but I think that it's a much narrower gap than it was.
Yeah, you know, and actually we were talking about that just before we started recording, about the personalization and how that's really, really ramping up and super important now. And the way that the various technology companies are now looking and analyzing at all the content that they've got on for emotion, action, all sorts of various different optics, and then personalizing the thumbnail to your own viewing history, which is incredible, really, you know.
Yeah, no, that's right. And I think that it feels like it is really at a sort of optimization stage now. So huge amounts of A/B testing to work out what if we just change it slightly in this way. I think it's interesting the way that AI is helping with the metadata problem. So for a long time, there just wasn't good enough information about programs to sort of power that discovery experience. My favorite example is when we sort of launched you watch this, you might also like this, similar to Amazon, Netflix, etc. And sort of doing it out of the box with the machine, it would say, you liked Fleabag, therefore you might like Mrs. Brown's Boys. And, you know, they're both comedies that have been on BBC One, but they're quite different. And it was like the metadata didn't exist to kind of distinguish those two things. And so I think it's interesting that there's, you know, AI can help with adding more metadata and actually watching the program itself and making sense of it, rather than it always relying on a human being typing in tags.
Yeah. Well, let's return to that veteran of AI terminology that I used earlier on, because you must have been working with nascent versions of AI or iterations of AI in the early iPlayer. Can you tell me about the first time that you started working with AI, and how did you implement it within iPlayer?
Yeah. So a couple of examples. So one was quite a prosaic example where we wanted to show an onward journey when the program finished and the credits started to roll, rather than all the way at the end of the credits, which no one ever got to. Everyone just had browsed away by that point. Could we get that bit of metadata of the time code when the credits started? No. Like, you feel like somewhere within the BBC that must have existed, but we couldn't find it. So one of the team developed a machine learning tool to automatically detect when the credit started. So fed it hundreds of different programs with all of the different types of scrolling credit. And the machine was able to then quite reliably say, oh, it looks like the credits start here. So now's the moment to surface that onward journey. I think it's I like it as an example because it's quite a boring thing, really, just coming up with a time code. But actually,
it's crucial, right?
Crucial. And the sort of thing that would have taken humans just so many hours to do, it wouldn't have been worth it. Also in the recommendation space, I think when iPlayer was in its early days, we just sort of got whatever was available off the shelf. And then we made a decision to kind of bring that in-house and to develop those algorithms ourselves in order to have a greater level of control over it, as that became the sort of the USP of being able to surface the right content. And, you know, Tim Davie, the Director General, recently talked about the importance of what's the public service take on how you make those algorithms work, so they're not just optimized for here's more and more of the same. And so I think that's, you know, ownership of those algorithms and being able to fine tune them has become more important.
And the training data is obviously BBC produced content, but also licensed content as well. But the algorithms that are powering the iPlayer were all developed in-house, essentially, and owned by the BBC.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, initially we were getting things off the shelf, but now we've developed in-house systems to do that, using both the kind of metadata in the programs, but also the usage data and what programs people are watching.
Interesting. Well, there's lots of discussions about ethical AI that we've been having on the show. And, yeah. and I'm sure that's going to be a bigger and bigger issue as we go on in terms of the data that is used to train these various AI tools. So, well, let's come on to talk about the current state of play then in terms of AI and how it's being deployed within the TV and the content production process. How do you see the maturity of what's being rolled out right now, you know, and the usability? Because there seems to be, you know, so many different tools for every part of the production process, from, you know, ideation to dubbing and research and all the rest of it. How do you see that landscape? Because you're studying this on a daily basis.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say it's really mixed. So I think that there are producers who are really rushing in and kind of getting stuck in. I think more common is being a bit more circumspect. And I feel quite often my opening conversation includes the, oh, we think we might be a bit late to this, but hopefully you can help us catch up. And I think actually it's just really early days. I think that it's sort of hard to kind of keep track of how quickly it's evolving, but actually I think we are really in the sort of foothills, and there isn't a rush. There isn't a need to sort of panic. I think practically where it's kind of proving most valuable at the moment is in development and pre-production and in post, and actually not so much in the sort of production process itself at the moment. So I think for the kind of, you know, idea generation, pitching, kind of all of the stuff that's happening at the start of the process, it's increasingly being used, sometimes, you know, secretly. And then I think, you know, there's a whole bunch of automated post-production tasks where it suddenly makes it economical to be in markets that you weren't in before in terms of, you know, subtitling or dubbing. And then I think it's starting to kind of appear within other tool sets. So the Adobe announced this week that they're going to start introducing some of these capabilities into Premiere Pro. So as well as their own video model, then also being able to support other video generation models within the tools, being able to easily, you know, remove items from the video, etc. So I think that's going to become more commonplace within the editing process. But I think the thing that I find myself saying a lot is just carve out some time to experiment. Like, I think that there's no need to pivot to kind of change what you're doing in the live production environment, but actually starting to get your head around it, creating some time and space. And that's difficult because the return's not immediate necessarily, although I do think quite often there are efficiencies around some of those really tedious tasks. Actually,
you can implement them straight away, right?
Exactly. Yeah, there are benefits to be had now, but I think the kind of, you know, just the discipline of creating some time to play around with it, because it's not always instantaneous, that benefit. It can take some time. And also trying different tools, like, they're not all the same. So I hear a lot of people say, oh, we tried using it for dubbing and it was rubbish, and it's like, actually try a different tool and it's pretty good. Yeah, that will work. So I think the time to experiment, I think, is key.
Yes, yeah. And don't sign up for any 12-month plans on any of these.
Indeed, it's moving so quickly. And I was slightly amused. So the Bloomberg went in early saying they were going to develop their own version of ChatGPT. So Bloomberg GPT, creative naming, and reportedly spent, you know, $10 million in the process. Someone recently did a comparison of the capabilities of that with the bog standard ChatGPT, the paid for version, and found that when it came to the financial tasks they were asking it to do, then ChatGPT was doing a better job. And so I think there's sort of, you know, in terms of the reasons to kind of wait and see before making really big decisions, then actually it's moving so quickly that you can wait a bit longer, and the thing you would have spent a fortune on is being offered for free.
Yeah. Yeah. And what I find really interesting is the timing of all of this. And perhaps it is more related the more you think about it, but obviously we're seeing the massive downturn in commissioning.
Yeah.
You're seeing, you know, which will start to affect rights and IP and how producers can create a more sustainable future for themselves.
Yeah.
And that's going to essentially, in many cases, be creating their own content, creating their own libraries, and actually almost creating their own mini iPlayer on YouTube, for example. Yeah. And that involves a whole lot of reversioning, a whole lot of content editing and, as you say, dubbing and all the rest of it. But so those tools are there, and you can do that now. And that I can see the adoption, you know, being quite high when it comes to these indies that are getting more and more involved in it. One thing that was interesting, I spoke to Frank Spotnitz, who's the writer on The X-Files, when I was at MIPTV recently, and I asked him how he was using AI. So this is, you know, a brilliant writer, Man in the High Castle, as I say, X-Files, X-Files movies, etc. Very, very successful. And his view on that was AI is like a hammer. AI is a tool, but we're the carpenters. Mm. And unless the carpenters upskill themselves and get to use the new hammer, then the money men, the corporations, the big content giants are going to see how they can use AI to, you know, to employ less carpenters.
Yeah.
So I think from that perspective, I think it is really interesting and important that producers do upskill themselves and carve out that time to play with.
Strongly agree. I think that, and I think it's a really helpful way of thinking about it, is approaching it as a, how can I get the best out of this tool? I was reading recently about the debates that raged in the 70s when calculators were first available and how they should be used in school. And clearly it's a much more powerful and versatile tool than the calculator. And yeah, I think that the accepting that this is going to be part of the future landscape of work and education and leaning into it and thinking, how can I make the best of it and use it responsibly, rather than sitting back a bit and worrying about it taking a job in the future.
Yeah. So one of the interesting things we're going towards now, we've got in terms of the general development of generative AI, we're at ChatGPT-4, which was a massive leap from ChatGPT-3. ChatGPT-5 is in development, and we don't know when that's going to be released. It's, from what I've heard, it might not come this side of the US election, because there's a lot of worry about the influence and the power.
Yeah.
There's still the same leap, or a bigger leap, which you imagine is probably a bigger leap between iterations, and the influence that that could have. What do you think the impact of AGI? Why don't you explain what AGI is?
Yeah, so I think that AGI, I would say, is not something to worry about just now. So essentially, this is kind of the point at which the machines are matching human intelligence, and you can kind of throw any task at them and they will perform it as well as a human could do. And there's kind of quite a lot of discussion about this. Elon Musk throwing out dates, as he likes to do, about just how close that could be achieved. No one knows, but I think it's a distraction and a bit of a red herring from some of the kind of issues that need tackling in the near term. So I think our trust in media, to me, feels like, and you know, as you're saying, that's a pressing concern. How are we going to tackle that as best as we can in the next 12 months? That feels like a better use of kind of thought cycles and airtime. I think, you know, there will be some people thinking about, you know, when we reach that point and kind of if and when, but it feels like it's disproportionately dominating the conversation and the news cycles and leading people, you know, down quite a fearful path. And I think actually the scientific community is quite divided on when it will happen or if it will happen at all.
I went to South by Southwest recently and I sat in quite a few of the panels around artificial intelligence. And Amy Webb, who's a fantastic researcher, I don't know if you've seen any of her videos and any of her talks from South by Southwest, but quite incredible some of the insights that she was sharing in terms of how AI is being deployed within biotech and tissue development, and also the shortage of microprocessors and the power needed for the next level of AI, which is going to be large action models based around wearables and everything else. And I know we're getting slightly off topic from TV perspective, but it's fascinating the speed with which this is going and the way that not only technology within the TV industry and is developing, but also parallel areas that are going to help fuel the capacity needed to drive a lot of these systems.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the kind of both the environmental impact of all of these systems needing to power and cool down AI processing, but also its potential to address a lot of those challenges that we're facing around the climate. Again, both of those things feel a little lower down in the news mix than I would like, really, because it feels like those are really over and above the possibility of killer robots, which feels like a lot further out. But I think it's interesting how, you know, as well as the kind of development of large language models, then it's sort of different domains are suddenly accelerating. So it feels like, you know, last year was a huge leap in terms of image quality. This year shaping up to be likewise for video. But then just in the last couple of months, then music has suddenly come to the fore. So a couple of kind of models have been released, so Suno and more recently Udio, and they just suddenly take it from the, well, this is clearly rubbish and AI generated, to, oh, well, that's, I mean, quite, it's sort of lacking a little bit, but they're kind of, you're starting to see those step changes. So I think the, you know, being able to pay attention to those changes in different domains and work through what it's going to mean in those spaces is really important. But yeah, I definitely feel like giving attention to, I believe, the huge positive impact that it's going to have in areas like medicine is an important balancing factor to call out, which doesn't necessarily get the airtime.
Yeah. Well, I'm guilty of sort of leading us off path slightly because I'm really fascinated with what AI is doing in various different sectors. But let's get back to TV and let's talk about text to video, because that feels like the next and most impactful area that we've started to see Sora over the last, you know, few months, and the way that that's been teased and generally rolled out. And again, that's what I'm hearing is that Sora, its capacity for deep fake must be, you know, incredible. Mm-hmm. So it probably is a good idea to wait until next year.
Yeah.
Once we've got a few important elections out of the way. But where do you see this going now in terms of text to video, and what are you seeing? Because it's more than Sora, isn't it? There are a number of different tools out there.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that it feels pre-Sora, it feels quite rudimentary, a lot of the tools. So I think it's miraculous that it can do it, but the deficiencies are quite obvious. So in terms of sort of, I'd say the leading tool at the moment pre-Sora is Runway, which is very impressive. However, you can only generate sort of between kind of 3 and 15 seconds maximum, and some of the, its inability to have a sort of an understanding of the physics of the world is quite evident in most instances. And that's something which it looks like Sora has made some real strides with. So I think I feel like we're in a little bit of a waiting pattern around video until Sora arrives and we can all get our hands on it. I mean, I still think it's worth kind of having a play around with some of those tools. So just recently, a tool called Hyper, where instead of a Y, it's an AI, of course, has been made available to leave free to use, which is unusual in that space because video generation's expensive. And I think it's worth having a play around. However, it feels like it's in the kind of having a play state at the moment. However, I anticipate it won't stay in that space for long once Sora and other models arrive. So Adobe have announced they're developing Firefly Video. Google's got its own model, Lumiere, which it's developing. And there's a few sort of startups shaping up in that space. So I think it's definitely going to be, I blogged in February about my sort of 11 AI prediction for the year, of which one was, we'll see a huge step change in video. And a week later, then someone from AI emailed me a link to the Sora video saying, is this what you had in mind? And I was like, I wasn't expecting that much and that quick. So it does feel like we're going to see it really accelerate. Although, as you say, I think it's interesting to what extent things may be held back in view of the...
Yeah. And it's also, you know, it seems a bit of a free-for-all in terms of the data that's been used to train these models.
Yeah.
So as far as we're aware, OpenAI and Sora is being trained, and, you know, this may not be there's only a certain amount of information that they've released so far, but it feels like the general internet is what Sora has been trained on. But whereas you have got, as you mentioned there, Adobe Firefly, they have obviously got a closed walled garden of their own licensed stock.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, all the data that's been used to train that model is, you know, there are royalties going back to the creators of that content, whether it be photos or videos or images, which seems to me to be the ethical way forward. And you would imagine that being a sort of an industry standard that will, you know, we'll start to get to once content is started to be accepted by broadcasters. It can't just be trained on anything, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that the another one of my 11 predictions was lots more licensing deals. So I think that the, you know, New York Times is currently suing OpenAI. I don't expect that to go all the way to trial. I think that they will, you know, they will settle. It's all about the right price. It sort of reminds me of the early days of YouTube, which it's easy to forget was kind of a hugely copyright infringing startup when it began. And there was that process of kind of, right, what do we need to put in place to make this legit? And it feels like that has to happen. But I think it's tough to, at the moment, it feels like there is a bit of a trade-off between the kind of the ethical choice and the best choice, a bit like kind of buying a house. It feels like right now you have to trade off something. So I think when it comes to, you know, image generators, then in terms of quality, I would say Midjourney is still ahead of the pack. However, I think it's safe to say that has been trained on pretty much anything they could get their hands on. By contrast, Adobe Firefly and iStock by Getty Images, you can be more confident about the training set and that the creators are being, you know, getting a very small recompense for that. But the quality isn't as good. I think.
Well, it's probably less data, right? Rather than general internet.
It's less data, and it's also less breadth. So it's interesting. There have been a few stories recently about Adobe actually putting calls out to photographers and to video saying, we need more content. Can you send us, you know, 500,000 photos of bananas in real life situations? This is genuinely, you know, for kind of not that much, like $80, or can you, you know, shoot these instances of real life video in order to train the model? Because I think the video that they've got in their stock training set is of quite a particular type. So if you want to create an image or a video of people at a, you know, a wedding, they've got lots to go on. If it's something more fantastical and that you've never conceived of, I think both Adobe Firefly and iStock, the results often look like a sort of photo montage. Someone's used stock photography to try and paste together a dog on a skateboard rather than conceiving it in a way that those models with more liberal training policies have achieved.
That's interesting. So there might be a time when freelance video might be required, you know, there might be opportunities there for them to shoot content, you know, specifically to train AI models for ethical services.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, I think running out of training data is a big concern already for the major players, that the, you know, they did everything they could get their hands on and all of the best quality stuff. Looking in the barrel, there's it's not looking that good. And so, you know, interestingly, sort of the Apple recently have automatically transcribed lots of every podcast. That's like an incredibly new, rich source of training data, potentially having all of that in text form. But yeah, I think the desire for high quality new training data is not going to go away because these models are so hungry for new data, and the cupboard's a bit bare.
There we are. Business opportunity there for any of those freelancers that are struggling right now. The entrepreneurial ones, maybe there is something there. Okay, so let's do a bit of future gazing, though. So you said you had 11 predictions. Mm. And I wrote down here a question to ask you. So what is, you know, I thought, I can't say 5 years. You know, what's where we're going to be in 5 years? So I thought, I know, maybe 3 years, maybe. Also feels probably a bit too far in the distance. But let's say generally, where can you see, once Sora's rolled out and presumably lots of other competing products, in terms of text to video and video production? Where do you see things going in you know, the months to come?
So I think it's quite likely that online content creators and the gaming industry will move a bit quicker into some of this stuff than traditional TV production. And I think that's partly because it's less of a leap from some of what they're doing at the moment, but also they're less exposed. And I think it's interesting. It feels we're in a period at the moment where any use of generative AI is quickly jumped on. So a couple recently, the BBC opted to use a AI voice clone to render someone's voice in a documentary who wasn't able to speak anymore. And everyone had jumped on that as this is, you know, denying a real actor some work without any kind of nuance around the particular context. So I think there's a bit of a lot of the companies I'm working with are thinking about things, but are nervous about putting their head above the parapet. Whereas I think doing that in a online creator space or in gaming is much less risky. So I think they are gonna leap into that in a way that you wouldn't necessarily on primetime TV. I think it's also important to, people need to work out how to be transparent about their use of AI in a meaningful way. And I think the BBC put out a statement a while ago saying, we'll always be open and transparent whenever we use generative AI in our output. To me, that feels quite quickly, we'll get to, that's like saying, we've used computers in making this program. It's like, so, you know, to get back to your question, I think it will be, in 3 years' time, it will be ubiquitous in lots and lots of small ways throughout the production chain, such that you couldn't put a title card on screen saying, here's all of the 100 ways in which AI has been used. And in fact, the sort of, you know, sessions I've been to with legal experts, it's like, AI is already everywhere. It's, you know, the auto suggest or the spell checker is that it could be argued to be AI. So don't say you're not using AI. So I think it will definitely be everywhere. It's going to be particularly rich in terms of the content production space. So I think that a lot of my time at the BBC was focused on the distribution half of the equation and going from the maturity of broadcast to this wild west of online. It feels like the distribution space is more mature and there's kind of slow changes between the big platforms, but actually the scope for transformation on the production side is enormous and we're only just beginning to see it. But I think we'll see more kind of integration with existing tools. So similar to the Adobe announcement this week, at the moment, it feels like you do need a huge selection of subscriptions to all of these separate standalone products in order to then try and bring it together. I think that things will start to consolidate and you'll be able to achieve more of that within a single tool. So just kind of where you need it within that production process, it will be on hand rather than having to jump between lots of different services.
Yeah. AI technology arms race for the TV industry potentially.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
And do you think that YouTube and basically creators publishing content on other social media, but particularly YouTube, because there's much more opportunity to earn, do you think those will be kind of like the nursery slopes, you know, because there's no Ofcom, you know, there's no compliance really to worry about. And actually recently YouTube did insert a checkbox when you're actually publishing that, you know, you have to self-declare that you're using AI. And it's a very specific line, but, you know, to change the nature of what you're experiencing on screen, yeah, as opposed to editing tools or anything. You could see that YouTube and social media is really going to be the nursery slopes for all of this technological development and testing, seeing what sort of content, generative AI developed content is going to do well.
I think definitely, and I think it's already happening. So I think I've talked to production companies who've talked about the tremendous ways in which they're using AI and then said, we're not using that on commission stuff. We're only using that on stuff we're putting direct online.
We'd never do that.
Yeah. Right. So yeah, I think exactly as you say, there's real kind of scope to experiment in that space in a kind of public way, but without having to clear some of the high bars of putting that in a broadcast context.
And now it's that time in the show where my guests get to choose the TV industry news story that's caught their eye in the past week or so. Dan, what's your story of the week?
Well, there's no competition, really, which is the big news in my household, is that Bluey is coming back. There is going to be more Bluey. For those of you not following it, then there's a big finale to the end of the third series, a 28-minute bumper episode, and then a lot of speculation that was going to be it. However, the news is now out that it is definitely coming back. Not a huge surprise. It would be it's a very lucrative franchise to leave there. There was an article a couple of weeks ago in Bloomberg, which had the amazing stat that the 29% of all TV viewing on Disney Plus in the last quarter of 2023 was Bluey, is accounting for almost a third of TV views on Disney Plus from one title.
Yeah. And I think I also read in a similar piece that Disney declined to pick up the rights for, I think it was the amusement rights or the game park rights or whatever.
Yeah, the merchandising, which a decision they say they now regret.
Yes. Yeah, I bet they do. Well, we'll see Bluey Land popping up. I'm sure we will, all over the internet and probably in real life as well.
Yeah.
All right, that's Bluey. So how about Hero of the Week? Who's your Hero of the Week, Dan?
So my Hero of the Week is Ethan Mollick, who is a US university professor who's just written a really good book about AI. And by good, I mean it's accessible and it's really sensible, and I'm recommending it to everyone. So I think a lot of the conversation about AI is very polemicized, and it's either our savior or our doom. And this is just an incredibly sensible, practical book. And it's great to have someone in that space who's doing that rather than the clickbaity, shouty stuff.
Yeah. So. And this is a physical book, is it?
It's a physical book. Yes. Wow. It's called Co-Intelligence, Living and Working with AI. And you can get it in dead tree format or on your e-reader as well.
Yes. All right. Well, anybody interested, go and have a look for that. And how about get in the bin, Dan? Who or what are you telling to get in the bin this week?
So I'm going to tell Adobe to get in the bin.
Whoa, okay.
So despite the good news around Premiere Pro, then it's all come out in the last couple of weeks that they used some Midjourney AI-generated images to train. So their whole USB has been, it's commercially safe to use Adobe Firefly. And so I think it's a bit disappointing that the...
Well, that's debatable, that claim now, right? I mean...
I think so, because the images from Midjourney will have been trained on all sorts of copyrighted data. And so images on top of that, it feels like... So yeah, I'm disappointed, Adobe. Do better.
Right. Okay. Well, I think my prediction for the next 12 months is there's going to be a lot of copyright lawyers who are going to make a lot of money, which, you know... What's new there, right? Dan, thank you so much for coming on Telecast. It's been brilliant to speak to you, and all the best. We'll see you soon.
Thanks, Justin.
Well, that's all for this week's show. Telecast was recorded in London and produced by Spirit Studios. Don't forget to subscribe to Telecast on YouTube. You can find a link in the episode description or just search Telecast TV on YouTube and hit subscribe. We'll be back with another interview with one of the content industry's movers and shakers next week. Until then, stay safe.